I always wanted to have a central driving position, and initially I had thought about doing a central seat car and just a single occupant car.
Sometimes the creative process can travel as fast as the speediest sports car. For Gordon Murray, designer of the McLaren F1, often considered one of the greatest road cars, the process meant slowing things down a little and getting in gear with some of the biggest ideas in automotive design.
But I think that would have limited, and I'm sure it's true, would have limited the sales because, you know, when you have something special, you want to share it with somebody and show people how it goes.
Start your engines. We're taking a four-wheel tour of the best the road can offer today on Section D. This is Section D, Monocle's weekly design show, and I'm your host, Josh Fennett. Also today, we ask about the potential pitfalls of driverless cars.
But have you actually seen the Google car? It does a disservice to Toys R Us. It's an unintended contraceptive on wheels.
We'll look at why the age of self-driving cars might not be as desirable as we've been led to believe. Plus,
when you take the material into the human world and you evaluate it, it's really interesting for us. And we tried to take it from a sort of opposite direction, thinking about the emotional relationship between humans and materials.
Part 3 of our Ljubljana design mini-series that takes us deep underground. All that coming up right here on Section D on Monocle 24. Now, it's been 25 years since the McLaren F1 wowed the motoring world when it was launched at the Sporting Club in Monaco on a May day in 1992. What's been described as the ultimate road car took just 4 years to plan, design and build, and only 106 were ever made, of which just 64 were road vehicles, the rest serving as prototypes and racing cars. In creating his vision, South African-born designer and McLaren technical director, Gordon Murray, kept the car's weight to a minimum and painstakingly thought through the car's streamlined structure. Murray was driving another one of his machines at the Goodwood Festival of Speed recently, the first car he ever designed, the IGM Ford. He sat down with James Whaley to discuss the legacy of McLaren F1 and share his thoughts on why good automotive design is all about focus.
We set out to just do the best engineered car we could and the best driver's car. You have no idea if it's going to become a classic, let alone iconic. I just did the best with my knowledge of design, really.
What did you want to achieve with the F1, and when did you first start the design process of the car?
McLaren had a brand in Formula One, but they had no brand in automotive. So what I wanted to do, I said to the other guys, what we need to do is start at the top, because if you start there, you know, you've set the standard for the brand. So with that in mind, I just set out to do the best car I could, both from a driving point of view, driving experience point of view, and also from an engineering and packaging point of view. I started thinking about the car in 89, when I was still in Formula One, the last year in Formula One, and actually started the design end of 89.
And you've designed a number of iconic F1 cars. Of course, the Brabham fan car is here, which of course was to counter the ground effect cars of the time. So what was the main design techniques you wanted to employ from Formula One, in the McLaren F1?
Well, being a racing car designer, it's quite natural that you have a lot of experience, for example, in composites, primary structures, chassis, body. And I wanted it to be the world's first carbon fiber car. It was also the world's first ground effect aerodynamics road car. So those two came straight from Formula One. And then beyond that, there were a lot of things on it that you couldn't do in Formula One. For example, it was the first car with active aerodynamics, which of course was banned in Formula One. So it was a mixture of Formula One technology, but then also stuff that I wasn't allowed to do in racing.
Did you always want it to be, thinking about the design, did you always want it to be a 1+2? Obviously, it's a very memorable design of the driver sitting ahead of his two passengers, rather than a single-seater. Obviously, you've designed a single-seater since, the light car company Rocket. But did you want it initially to be a single-seater, or was it always set out to have passenger seats?
I always wanted it to have a central driving position. And initially, I had thought about doing a central seat car and just a single occupant car. But I think that would have limited, and I'm sure it's true, would have limited the sales, because, you know, when you have something special, you want to share it with somebody and show people how it goes. So I think the arrowhead formation, which is something I thought dreamt up as early as 69, solved both problems.
Another notable feature, of course, is the engine bay that everybody remembers, lined with gold because of the heats generated by the 620 horsepower engine. Had that been done before? Where was that design aspect from?
The gold foil comes from satellites. So satellites are covered with that to protect them from the sun's radiation. And it was a simple engineering choice. So we picked 10 materials and we did our own in-house testing. And the gold foil was heads and shoulders above the others for protection from radiant heat, which is one of our big problems with a sealed engine bay. So it was really just a technical choice.
Even the pedals, I've looked at pictures of the pedals and they have a mix of form and function, and each cabin could be customised, I understand. Can you remember any particular changes in the design within the car that certain customers requested?
Not really. I made the car very, very adjustable. We even had three discrete positions to mount the pedals, for example, and the steering wheel was set up for rake and for fore and aft adjustment for each customer. We even made customized seats for people. So, I mean, we went as far as you possibly could. It was almost like a racing car fitting, you know, where each car is tailored around the driver. That's the feeling I wanted to give the owners, that it was their car. They were coming in. I made a seating buck where people came in and were fitted to the car. That was all part of the ownership experience. It wasn't just practicality.
What are you most proud about the design aspects of the car?
I think,
if you can pick just the one aspect, yeah, or a couple.
I think the thing I'm most proud about is the construction, because, as I say, it hadn't been done before. People had used bits of composites in cars, bits of carbon fibre, but nobody had done a complete carbon fibre motor car with no metal in it at all. And that had some big challenges, very, very big challenges. And the fact that we overcame those and still made the car durable and reliable is something that's not easy to do. Yeah.
And obviously, it's a beautiful car as well. It has no wings, it has ground effects, so never needed any extra addenda. It's a beautiful piece of machinery, as well as very functional and very clever.
Yes, I got a little bit of stick from a few journalists when we launched the car that it wasn't too outrageous, you know. But I purposely didn't want the styling to have any fixed wings or too many ducts and things like that. I wanted the style to be classic and the proportions to be classic. Most people liked it, but I did get a little bit of stick that it didn't look outrageous like a Lamborghini. But my concept was, and I told the design team, that I wanted it to look good in 20 or 30 years' time.
Yeah. It's been added to for the Le Mans series, and it became a little bit more outrageous, I would say, in the GTR cars. Were you involved in that part of the design process for them to become GTRs and to compete in Le Mans?
I mean, yeah, that was me altogether. I only had one day in the wind tunnel. I borrowed the Formula One wind tunnel. They were so busy. I literally had one day to do the GTR racing kit, which turned out to be just a wing, a little bit of bodywork change, and a spoiler on the front, which is a day's work in the wind tunnel.
Money was no object. You were out to design the best analog car ever made.
Well, that's not for me to judge, actually, but it seems to still be held up as one of the best cars from the point of view of a driving experience. It's a very involving car, which I think a lot of the modern cars aren't, as they do a lot of stuff for you. So it involves the driver in virtually every aspect of car control.
Finally, over the past 25 years, what's the car that's come closest to matching the F1 in terms of design, if any has, would you say?
Oh, that's a difficult one. I mean, there's been a plethora of supercars and carbon cars since then. I know this sounds a bit big-headed, but I don't think any of them have been single-person focused enough. And the problem is, when you get away from a single-person car, like the Mini, the original Mini, or the original Cinquecento, which were one-person cars, stuff gets watered down. A good example is the car we went on to make, the SLR, after the F1. It was a team effort, if you like, and it had compromises. And I think virtually everything after the F1 is compromised.
The Goodwood Festival of Speed here, you're in your first ever design car, which we've seen is based around a Lotus 7. Could you just give us a quick history of your IGM Ford.
Yeah, actually, the IGM Ford's got absolutely nothing to do with the Lotus 7. It just so happens, unfortunately, I used the Lotus 7 nose cone. It's actually 80 kilos lighter than a 7 and probably double the torsional stiffness and a lot lower. It's just I wanted to be a racing driver and I had no money, so the only way I could be a racing driver when I was 18 was to design and build a car, so that's what I did.
Just one last question. What is your next shoot when it comes to design? Would you like to, is there a car that you haven't designed or a concept or an idea that you would like to put into fruition?
Well, we're doing a lot of interesting stuff at Gordon Murray Design right now. We're designing a whole lot of different motor cars, from off-road trucks to city cars and sports cars. But I've probably got one more supercar left in me, and I'm thinking about it at the moment.
McLaren F1 designer Gordon Murray there, speaking to James Whaley. Still to come on Section D, we'll look at why the obsession with driverless cars won't suit everyone. Few have perfected the art of motoring in style quite like Gotham City's favourite caped crusader, Batman. The screen's original Batmobile, as seen in the television series of the 1960s, was designed by George Barris. Given just a few weeks to complete the project, he adapted an existing Lincoln Futura concept car, which had been built in 1955 by the lauded Italian auto design firm Ghia. The metaphorical mailbag is always open to queries and suggestions. Do get in touch by emailing our producer, Ben Rylan. He's on br@monocle.com. This is Section D. Please do stay tuned. One day, state-of-the-art motorcars may arrive without a key piece of hardware that's defined it in the past, the steering wheel. Self-driving cars are the way of the future, or at least that's what we're told. The reality, of course, is rather more mundane. Here's Monocle's very own Robert Bound with his own steer on the situation.
The home of the 21st century. What will it be like? How will we choose to live in the next 34 years?
Have driverless cars stalled? Unlike the starry-eyed promise of square-jawed businessmen throttling from deal to deal by jetpack, driverless cars are the 1960s view of the future that we don't need. We wanted hoverboards, we were promised monorails, but driverless cars? They're the electric carving knife of the mobility sector, the DVD case disguised as a Tolstoy of the motoring world. What are driverless cars? Are they cars at all? If a black cab is a car driven by an expert, then a yellow taxi is a car steered by a wise guy. If an Uber is a car commanded by a computer but operated by an immigrant, then a driverless car is a car commanded by a computer and operated by a computer. Is it just a system? Is it a small train? Is it a morality tale on wheels? If so, what's it doing in your driveway? What is a driverless car for? Getting drunk but not getting lucky?
The kitchen of tomorrow could look more like a laboratory than a place to bake a cake.
Driverless cars may just be transport tools for inveterate boozers. Imagine a high-technology system specifically designed for drivers who can't trust themselves not to stop by the Red Lion for a couple of pints on their way home from the office.
Speed, safety, and comfort will be the keynotes of tomorrow's highways. A multicolored highway system may enable the motorist to reach his destination.
Many people below the age of 40 in the world's capitals don't own a car. They hire one for the night or by the hour. Cities are congested, cars get scratched. Where do I park it? What happens if I want a drink? Are all understandable stances. Actually, they're not. Driverless cars are really for a generation that's so consumed by technology's cheap tricks and flimsy baubles that they'd actually go out and buy one, going third to their flatmates, Natch, just because it's made by Apple or Google.
Ladies and gentlemen, today the first of what may be as many as 10 million families per year is setting out on its epic voyage into man's newest frontier for colonization, deep space.
When I first heard that driverless cars A could exist and soon after B do exist, I thought, great, I'll move to LA, go to some fun parties in my Maserati, and then it can drive me slash us home. Hurry up, the future. But have you actually seen the Google car? It does a disservice to Toys R Us. It's an unintended contraceptive on wheels. It's the zenith of the no-taste-is-good-taste branch of i-minimalism that thinks it's saying, I don't need to make a statement to make a statement, but is actually saying, willfully force me off the road until I am but flames.
I'll get it! Oh, hello! You're Mr. Spacely, aren't you?
And you, of course, are Mrs. Jetson.
While we're here, what do you think about driverless planes? Are you okay with that? It's probably possible to fly a Boeing 777 without needing a cockpit full of blokes in caps and epaulettes, but would you happily pay to board a drone and fly to Shanghai?
When I drive to work, I'm surrounded by cyclists and buses and other cars, and they're all tuned in. Most of those on the roads, really those cyclists, please take your earphones out, are engaged in the act of getting from A to B. Give in to the driverless car and you're visiting one more inhuman act upon the highways and byways of the world. Driverless cars, they're worse than a crash. So while you're dismantling your noddy car, put your know-how into what? Jetpacks and hoverboards. Don't you remember the future?
Monocle's Robert Bound there on why he'd sooner take a jetpack or monorail than a self-driving car. As we've heard on the past few shows, the world's longest-running design biennale is in full swing, with a mission to raise eyebrows and bend minds. Far Away So Close is the title of the 25th edition of the Ljubljana Design Biennial. It's led both designers and visitors out of their comfort zones to places far removed from the Slovenian capital's design museum. Participants have already communed with nature and taken a walk for the installation in a forest by Mitali Kraset. But now they're going underground for an extravaganza of light and sound directed by Italian design duo Former Fantasma. Monocle's very own Guy Delorne packed his bags and summoned a spirit of adventure by catching the bus to Supernova Jama to find out more.
Music, food and wine greet our arrival at Supernova Jama. It's an underground complex of caverns at Grosuplja to the south of Ljubljana. And this is where the Italian designers Former Fantasma have directed their episode of the biennial, Underground Release. Simone Farasin is one half of the dynamic duo.
The work is a reaction to the Curatoria Brave. And you know, the starting point was to engage with the locality, which is a very specific locality, which is the Karst Cave. So the outcome, as often our work, is a reflection of the starting point.
What challenges did it present you working in a cave?
More than a challenge, I think when you are a designer, you select things that you think are interesting. And I think for us, what was interesting is that a bit that was also part of the Curatoria Brave. The idea was to rethink the meaning of very specific places in these, you know, very far away locations, as a Karst cave might be. But I think what was interesting is that for us, we realized that a place like that don't have meaning, and we should not, as designers, reinterpreting it, assigning it a function. So actually the work that we develop is very much reflecting on ideas that can arise from the cave, but without thinking of assigning it a function. And that for us was very interesting because it opens up possibilities and to explore design in a more abstract level. And the whole work questions the way we engage with production and also how we as designers are participating in transforming natural resources into desirable products.
Former Fantasma's biennial products include tiles made from the same limestone as the cave, but the key to their installation is collaboration. The main players in the cave are lighting designer Dan Andalšić and physicist cum poet Andrej Tatela, and designer Eva Jaeger contributed to a film to complement the cave installation.
When you take the material into the human world and you evaluate it, it's really interesting for us. And that's sort of the direction that Forma Fantasma went in making objects, and we tried to take it from a sort of opposite direction, thinking about the emotional relationship between humans and materials. So that's why in our film it's really about a character being seduced by a cave and ultimately ends up in this sort of trance dance in the cave. We also have an installation which is on display at the Supernova Cave. It uses laser and sound and also an instrument that's been made from the corings. It's a completely immersive audiovisual experience that's trying to tap into all of these emotions that one can have with the cave before you even start to extract it and evaluate it.
And I hope that you will come here again.
Supernova Jama translates as the mayor's cave, so it's only fitting that the civic leader of the area is on hand to offer his personal guarantee that nothing will be going bump in the night.
We have ghosts here, and they said, okay, it's a special location, so until from now to 2 o'clock, there will be no ghosts. After that, please, I'm not responsible. Have a great pleasure here and hope to see you soon again. All the best.
A personal welcome from the mayor of Grosuplia. It sounds like the cave is going to be safe at least for the next couple of hours. I'm not entirely sure it's a brilliant idea to bring dozens of people who've been drinking, in some cases quite heavily, into the bowels of a system of caverns with stalagmites and stalactites that can break open your head in the middle of the night when they're already, frankly, already a little bit on the tired side. Hey, Simone, you're trying to kill us, mate.
Yes, that's the plan. Well, we just wanted to say that the voice you will hear is the voice of André, who is a scientist and a physicist and a poet and so on. Somehow the interventions with light is meant to give a literal different reading of the space, which, as you experienced so far, will be very different during the show. Thank you.
The acoustic noise incorporates many different frequencies, and there can be a chaotic relationship between these frequencies.
Your correspondent is standing next to a visibly stunned James Taylor Foster. He's the European editor-at-large for Arc Daily and full of admiration for the former Phantasma installation.
That was incredible. I mean, I've never been in a... I mean, there's a cave system. There's this kind of a whole cave system in which... Well, what was it? A sand installation? What would you call it? A light or sand installation? But, you know, it was incredibly moving, actually. I mean, there's something about the silence of these caves, which is kind of staggering, and then when it's filled with artificial light and sound, and yeah, pretty magnificent.
What are we getting out of this in terms of this being a design biennial? We've got this amazing spectacle. What's it doing for us in terms of design?
I think this is a more playful approach to write design a spectacle. I think a design a spectacle is an important thing. Design is meant to be beautiful, and I think it's fascinating that they actually took this kind of ridiculously naturally beautiful space and layered it with something very simple but very carefully orchestrated, very carefully designed, and actually elevated it.
I mean, this is projecting lasers across a natural rock formation, not just any natural rock formation, but these amazing beautiful underground caverns where fluid statuary has taken shape naturally. But the lasers were synchronized with the voice and the sound in terms of the frequency response of the laser.
And
they
took you to a very single point in the room, right? They focused your attention, because this is a very overwhelming space when it comes down to it. It's just magnificently complex. And to kind of draw your attention through design to a single point and then to elevate that moment is beautiful.
While the visitors are reeling, Simone Farrison settles for quiet satisfaction at the success of the project.
I think what was very special about this biennial is that we have been forced, and pleasantly so, in a collaborative process with a lot of different practitioners. And I think that is what I will take home. Like, it's the first time that we engage with so many different people in a project, and that makes it very exciting and unpredictable. So I'm very much process-based. So I think that is what will definitely affect my practice in the future, where we will definitely be even more open in the process and actually be ready to be surprised ourselves with the outcome.
That's certainly true for the visitors to the mayor's cave, and we didn't even have to lose anyone underground. At least, I don't think we did. For Monocle, at Jupanova Yama, I'm Guy Delaunay.
Our thanks to our very own Belgrade correspondent who is in Ljubljana for that report. Thank you, Guy Delorne. Now, before we leave this week, a few stories that have caught our eye. NBC Nightly News has unveiled a new set incorporating 632 square feet of LED video tiles. The new space, designed by firm Clickspring, gives NBC's nightly flagship bulletin a more cohesive approach to graphic storytelling. The future of news? It remains to be seen. A series of newly released images sheds light on an upcoming collaboration between IKEA and Danish brand Hey. The Epelig collection spans more than 30 pieces, from a 1950s-inspired sofa to the firm's very own take on the Scandinavian plank table. It's due to go on sale from this October. And for in-house news, the latest edition of our summer publication, The Escapist, hits newsstands this week. Among the treasures you'll uncover in the pages of Monocle's latest journal is a report on Japan's Tokuen Hotel, a 1960s architectural gem which, thankfully, the owners are happy to leave well alone. Next week, it's what's inside that counts, but never mind that, we're focusing on the outer layers with a special look at packaging design. But for now, I'm Josh Fennett, thank you very much for listening, and goodbye.